do is I'm going to pass around some resources. First, this is the book on public health law, last 3 years of my life. I was just telling another group, my wife said that I had a bad neck for 3 years when I wrote this, and the day it finished, my neck ended up fine. This is literally my only copy, and it only came out a couple of hours ago, so please, I'll pass it around, but hope I'll get it back at the end. For those of you who are interested in it, there's an order form. It's $25. It's good price. And then I'll also pass around this three-part JAMA article. I didn't bring enough with me, but if anybody like a copy of the three-part series, what I will do is just email me. The email is right at the bottom of the JAMA articles. It's just goston@law.georgetown.edu. Do you want me to do it this way? Okay, fine. I noticed that some of the same crew is here, so I'm going to apologize to Gene, Tony, and Deb for going over some territory that I did before. For those of you who are interested in public health law, I think it's quite important to know that the general counsel of the CDC is here. Gene Matthews had 20 years of experience on the ground doing those kinds of things. And in addition, there is Tony Moulton, who's the head of the new CDC Public Health Law Program, a new initiative, and maybe during question times we can talk about that. And Dev Erickson is the head of the Robert Wood Johnson Turning Point Initiative on public health law modernization. And so maybe, Deb, you could also talk a little bit about that as we go along. I don't know how long a talk I should really give, since I'd really like to hear from you, but maybe what I'll do is just give a little bit of a flavor for what I'm going to talk about and what's in the book and the JAMA articles, and then you can think about how we should discuss it. When I first thought about the field and started writing the book several years ago, it had occurred to me that there had been a lot of discussion of public health law in the literature, but in fact, even when there were people were talking about public health law, they really didn't have a sense of the uniqueness of what public health was. And much of this was about personal health care financing and delivery, the doctor-patient relationship, informed consent, confidentiality, things like that. But there really wasn't a richer sense of what it meant to be a law about the population's health. So I've defined public health law as the study of the legal powers and duties of organized society to assure the conditions for people to be healthy. That's really based upon the famous Institute of Medicine definition. And it's a wonderful definition because it asks the question, who has the duty? And it's we all do, organized society. And what is the duty that we have? The duty that we have isn't to make people healthy or even necessarily to give people healthcare services. First, you can't make people healthy because they come with all kinds of different illnesses and disabilities. And also, healthcare is part of the answer to public health, but it's only one part of the answer. And so what the IOM tried to do is to make a sense of what it means to assure the conditions for people to be healthy, like sanitation, clean air, clean water. Ed really went through them, I thought, quite nicely. The other part of public health law is the idea that it does create limits. Ed talked about this as well. It limits autonomy, privacy, liberty, property, or other legally protected interests. Sometimes, not always, but it can do that to protect the community's health. When you think about public health law, I think it's really important for us to kind of get beyond much of the scholarship and discussion that's pervaded the United States in the last 20 or 30 years based upon the idea of bioethics and health law, which focused on individual rights, asking people, well, what kind of rights do you have as a private citizen? What kind of interests do you have? And very little thoughtful conversation about what it means to have duties that we owe one to another. So what public health is, I think, is it's achieved through collective action, not individual endeavor. I think you all know this, that it can only be created by the community as a whole, because only we, the community, have a stake in things like the environment, sanitation, clean air, uncontaminated food and water, safe roads and safe products. And that can only be achieved, as I say, through organized action on behalf of the population. A philosopher who thinks about theories of democracy, Michael Walzer, I think, put it nicely. He said, membership in political communities is important because of what it means to owe duties to one another. And the first thing we all owe is the communal provision of security and welfare. Political communities, the reason why we join together is because we have a shared bond among our members. We try to safeguard common goods to health and welfare and security. And it's that is the kind of tradition that in writing this book, I went back and looked at the tradition at the turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century. And that was also a tradition we had even early on in our Constitution, kind of the classic Republican classic Republicanism, which thought about these common goods. If you read Jacobson or any of the other major Supreme Court cases during those times, they talk in a language about public health that we really can't even talk about now. Go, for example, we're not in Washington, in my home state, but if you are there, go to the Roosevelt Memorial. It's the newest memorial in the city. And read what Eleanor and FDR were saying about the welfare of the community. It's not a language that you would dare have a politician talk about today, whether it's Gore or Bush or Clinton or any of them, really have lost that language. And in fact, we've become very much anti-public health in the sense that we are suspicious of government rather than welcoming government into as the kind of entity that we organize together to help each other. We're against taxation. We're against in redistribution of our resources. We seem to be prepared to live with vast disparities in health, particularly among socioeconomic and racial groups. All of these things were really not part of our culture. We're against regulation in any of its formats. These things we seem to have lost sometime after World War II. Why we lost them or how, I don't know. We even had them even with Lyndon Johnson, was even able to talk about the Great Society. But since that time, for somehow, we've lost the language of public health and we need to reinstill it. And I think that that's extremely important. I mean, just on a personal note, I mean, I do a fair amount of work with the CDC and also with NIH. And I think NIH does a wonderful job. I'm on a number of their advisory committees. They're a magnificent institution. But you go to their campus and you see the buildings and you look at their budgets and you see the amount of money we put into biomedicine and technology. And if you think that we spend 1/12 of our gross national product on healthcare, and then you think about the resources that are given to our public health agencies, both federal, state, and local, and it really is a mismatch. Why it happens, it's very, very difficult to understand. But we really, I think, have lost that importance. Bill Roper had a very nice quote. I've quoted it in the book. He was the head of the CDC, wasn't he? He was also the head of HCFA, that looked at the Medicare budgets and things. And he said that, well, he never stops being amazed that when he was the head of CDC, that they had rancorous disputes and arguments about small amounts of money that were rounding errors when he was at HCFA that nobody even thought about. And it's just, I think, an interesting commentary about where our national priorities lie. The Institute of Medicine, in its report on the future of public health, very influential, Ed talked about it. Part of their notion was the what they thought of as a crumbling public health infrastructure, and that was absolutely true. Less known is that the IOM had singled out public health law as part of that public health infrastructure and saying that our legal structure had foundered. And in fact, in my view, that is very true. Most of our laws are highly antiquated, as Jean Matthews and others have said many times. They tend to be organized layer upon layer. They basically started with smallpox and cholera and move up through polio, tuberculosis, HIV, AIDS, one layer after another, so that they're before any of our advancements in science, before the advent of constitutional law in the 1960s and 1970s. And I think are badly in need of repair. Yes, it's true that they tend to be very discretionary, and they say public health officials, you know, do what you want, essentially, whatever you think is right for the public health. And maybe public health officials want that, but I don't think that that's good for public health. Public health should get its mandate from the body politic. That is, the government should, through its legislation, enable and have a charge to public health people. It should tell them what their missions are, their essential functions are, the core services of public health. It should have a funding mechanism. It should have prospects for leadership in public health. And so all the things that the APHA and others are talking about in terms of reinvigorating public health, the law is very important, because you can't really have good public health agencies unless you have good foundations for those agencies. So my first message is that it's important to have this kind of good public health law infrastructure. Deb Erickson, through her Turning Point initiative, is very much involved in that. The second point that I want to emphasize is the point that CDC, Tony Moulton and his colleagues, Jean Matthews, a group at the CDC who've been talking about this problem, is that law can be an important tool for public health. It's not an unqualified good. Whenever you use law, you don't always achieve a good result. But there are very, very important things that we can do in using law as a tool for public health. And I'll just go through them very, very briefly. This is something that I've done for the IOM. And I have about five or six models for law as a tool. Model one is the taxing and spending power. Think about why we have a 21-year-old drinking age in this country. It's because it's a condition attached to federal highway funding. The taxing power is a huge instrument for regulation, in fact. We know that, for example, from cigarettes, but we could give many, many examples. But it's not always a universal good, as I say. For example, the cigarette tax that we probably would all support, I think, nonetheless is a highly regressive tax, and it falls disproportionately on the poor and the working class. Model two is to alter the environmental, physical, and social environment, the physical, social, and informational environment. There, we might talk about things like city planning. We might talk about things like exercise and access to food, good quality food in our neighborhoods and communities. We might talk about health education and health promotion in terms of education, labeling requirements, and control of commercial speech, for example, the kinds of healthful, adventuresome advertising that we do for cigarettes and alcoholic beverages. And even with firearms, there are some firearm advertisements that can be very misleading, suggesting that it actually is effective as an in-home protection when the data suggests otherwise. There are advertisements for firearms that advertise fingerprint-proof firearms. What good purpose could come of that? These automatic weapons that really have no good recreational purpose. So I do think there is an important role for public health there. Model 3 is what we all think about, but I'm putting it third, even though it's not necessarily the most important, it's still the most thought about, and that's direct regulation. We regulate individuals through seatbelt, motorcycle, helmet laws, for example, professionals through licensing requirements, businesses through searches and inspections, occupational health and safety standards. Model 4 is indirect regulation through the tort system. You've heard lots about this in terms of our litigation against cigarette manufacturers, firearm manufacturers, unsafe pharmaceuticals and vaccines. This has had a huge benefit. I mean, just think about the states now that are benefiting from the tobacco settlement and how important that could be. It's a shame in many ways that many of the states are not using this money for public health or smoking. I mean, that really is such a tragic lost opportunity for our country. But many states are, it has been very important. But again, not everybody agrees with it. People think it's anti-democratic because they think that the legislature, not the court, should be making these decisions. Some people worried about the fairness problem, being that only a few plaintiffs and plaintiffs' attorneys get the money, and so that the money isn't spread among all those who are harmed. But the tobacco settlement is a good way of avoiding those problems because lots of the money, most of the money, goes to the states, and the states could distribute it equitably and fairly and for a public health purpose. So I do think that there's an important role for litigation, although I am mindful that it's not it's a role that's disputed. Think about firearms litigation. That's a really interesting one. It shows the kind of interplay between politics and law. Public health officials like to think that they live in a world of science, and I wish they did, but they live in a world mostly of science, but they also live in a world of politics where they need to work with elected representatives. I know many public health people think that that's an impediment to their work, and they're afraid of the legislature, distrustful of them. And there's also distrust on the other side as well. I wonder if I could find that one little quote that I think you'd really appreciate. Yeah, here's one public health legislator who said to me, I'm quoting from him, he's a very prominent man, he objected to the notion that public health officials, and he emphasized being political appointees, make decisions that are scientific and good, and legislators make decisions that are political and bad. I'm aware of the fact that there is this tension, but I do think it's extremely important for public health leadership to work with elected officials and the political branches of government. And I say the same thing to legislators. They really should be working in a proactive basis with public health people. They shouldn't be talking in a crisis. They should be talking ongoing, which is extremely important. But I've diverged from my firearm discussion. Isn't this interesting? On the one hand, we say tort law is anti-democratic. And so if it's anti-democratic, soon the political branch of government tells public health attorneys what they should and shouldn't be doing. For example, in terms of regulation of firearms, I think, and Gene, please correct me if I'm wrong here, I think there are only two consumer products that are by law, by positive law, banned from regulation by consumer products regulatory agencies: tobacco and firearms. Tobacco, because the Supreme Court just said the FDA had no legislative authority, and firearms, because there was an affirmative act of Congress to say that firearms could not be regulated by the Consumer Product Safety Agency. And so what happens, cities bring lawsuits against firearm manufacturers. And then what happens, again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think about 18 or 19 states have now passed laws to say that the cities can't sue the firearm manufacturer. So you've got this interesting tension between the political branches, the judicial branches, the legal. I'll just end by this. I know most of you, I may be wrong here, but I think many of you came here out of duty and a loyalty to the public health physicians. You don't think about law as the first thing when you get up in the morning. Is that true? Maybe you do. Some of us do. But the intersection between public health, law, and ethics is endlessly fascinating. It's a subject that we could talk about and talk about. It involves good citizenship. It involves our democracy. And most importantly, it involves the health and well-being of our nation. And I don't think anything's more important than that. So thank you very much.